This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Hating Game by Sally Thorne, performed by Katie Shore. Chapter 1. I have a theory. Hating someone feels disturbingly similar to being in love with them. I've had a lot of time to compare love and hate, and these are my observations. Love and hate are visceral. Your stomach twists at the thought of that person. The heart in your chest beats heavy and bright, nearly visible through your flesh and clothes. Your appetite and sleep are shredded. Every interaction spikes your blood with a dangerous kind of adrenaline, and you're on the brink of fight or flight. Your body is barely under your control. You're consumed, and it scares you. Both love and hate are mirror versions of the same game, and you have to win. Why? Your heart and your ego. Trust me, I should know. It's early Friday afternoon. I'm imprisoned at my desk for another few hours. I wish I was in solitary confinement, but unfortunately I have a cellmate. Each tick of his watch feels like another tally mark, chipped onto the cell wall. We're engaged in one of our childish games, which requires no words. Like everything we do, it's dreadfully immature. The first thing to know about me, my name is Lucy Hutton. I'm the executive assistant to Elaine Pascal, the co-CEO of Bexley & Gammon. Once upon a time, our little Gammon publishing was on the brink of collapse. The reality of the economy meant people had no money for their mortgage repayments, and literature was a luxury. Bookstores were closing all over the city like candles being blown out. We braced ourselves for almost certain closure. At the 11th hour, a deal was struck with another struggling publishing house. Gammon Publishing was forced into an arranged marriage with the crumbling, evil empire known as Bexley Books, ruled by the unbearable Mr. Bexley himself. Each company stubbornly believing it was saving the other, they both packed up and moved into their new marital home. Neither party was remotely happy about it. The Bexleys remembered their old lunchroom foosball table with sepia-tinted nostalgia. They couldn't believe that airy-fairy Gammons had survived even this long, with their lax adherence to key performance indicator targets and dreamy insistence on literature as art. The Bexleys believed numbers were more important than words. Books were units. Sell the units. High-five the team. Repeat. The Gammons shuddered in horror, watching their boisterous new stepbrothers practically tearing the pages out of their Brontes and Austens. How had Bexley managed to amass so many like-minded stuffed shirts, far more suited to accountancy or law? Gammons resented the notion of books as units. Books were, and always would be, something a little magic, and something to respect. 1 year on, you can still tell at a glance which company someone came from by his or her physical appearance. The Bexleys are hard geometrics. The Gammons are soft scribbles. Bexley's move in shark packs, talking figures and constantly hogging the conference rooms for their ominous planning sessions. Plotting sessions, more like. Gammons huddle in their cubicles, gentle doves and clock towers, poring over manuscripts, searching for the next literary sensation. The air surrounding them is perfumed with jasmine tea and paper. Shakespeare is their pin-up boy. The move to a new building was a little traumatizing, especially for the Gammons. Take a map of this city. Make a straight line between each of the old company buildings. Mark a red dot exactly halfway between them, and here we are. The new Bexley & Gammon is a cheap gray cement toad squatting on a major traffic route, impossible to merge onto in the afternoon. It's arctic in the morning shadows and sweaty by the afternoon. The building has one redeeming feature, some basement parking, usually snagged by the early risers, or, should I say, the Bexleys. Elaine Pascal and Mr. Bexley had toured the building prior to the move, and a rare thing happened. They both agreed on something. The top floor of the building was an insult. Only one executive office? A total refit was needed. After an hour-long brainstorm that was filled with so much hostility, the interior designer's eyes sparkled with unshed tears. The only word Elaine and Mr. Bexley would agree on to describe the new aesthetic was shiny. It was their last agreement ever. The refit definitely fulfilled the design brief. The 10th floor is now a cube of glass, chrome, and black tile. You could pluck your eyebrows using any surface as a mirror. Walls, floors, ceiling. Even our desks are made from huge sheets of glass. I'm focused on the great big reflection opposite me. I raise my hand and look at my nails. My reflection follows. I stroke through my hair and straighten my collar. I've been in a trance. I'd almost forgotten I'm still playing this game with Joshua. I'm sitting here with a cellmate because every power-crazed war general has a second in command to do the dirty work. Sharing an assistant was never an option because it would have required a concession from one of the CEOs. We were each plugged in outside the two new office doors and left to fend for ourselves. It was like being pushed into the Colosseum's arena, only to find I wasn't alone. I raise my right hand again now. My reflection follows smoothly. I rest my chin on my palm and sigh deeply, and it resonates and echoes. I raise my left eyebrow because I know he can't, and as predicted, his forehead pinches, uselessly. I've won the game. The thrill does not translate into an expression on my face. I remain as placid and expressionless as a doll. We sit here with our chins on our hands and stare into each other's eyes. I'm never alone in here. Sitting opposite me is the executive assistant to Mr. Bexley, his henchman and manservant. The second thing, the most essential thing anyone needs to know about me, is this. I hate Joshua Templeman. He's currently copying every move I make. It's the mirror game. To the casual observer, it wouldn't be immediately obvious. He's as subtle as a shadow, but not to me. Each movement of mine is replicated on his side of the office, on a slight time delay. I lift my chin from my palm and swivel to my desk, and smoothly, he does the same. I'm 28 years old, and it seems I've fallen through the cracks of heaven and hell and into purgatory. A kindergarten classroom. An asylum. I type my password. I hate Joshua for Ev. At. My previous passwords have all been variations on how much I hate Joshua. Forever. His password is almost certainly I hate Lucinda forever. My phone rings. Julie Atkins from Copyrights and Permissions, another thorn in my side. I feel like unplugging my phone and throwing it into an incinerator. Hello, how are you? I always put an extra little bit of warmth into my voice on the phone. Across the room, Joshua's eyes roll as he begins punishing his keyboard. I've a favor to ask, Lucy. I can almost mouth the next words as she speaks them. I need an extension on the monthly report. I think I'm getting a migraine. I can't look at this screen any longer. She's one of those horrific people who pronounces it migraine. Of course, I understand. When can you get it done? You're the best. It'd be in by Monday afternoon. I need to come in late. If I say yes, I'll have to stay late Monday night to have the report done for Tuesday's 9 a.m. executive meeting. Already next week sucks. Okay. My stomach feels tight. As soon as you can, please. Oh, and Brian can't get his in today either. You're so nice. I appreciate how kind you're being. We were all saying you're the best person to deal with up there in exec. Some people up there are total nightmares. Her sugary words help ease the resentment a little. No problem. Talk to you Monday. I hang up and don't even need to look at Joshua. I know he's shaking his head. After a few minutes, I glance at him, and he is staring at me. Imagine it's 2 minutes before the biggest interview of your life, and you look down at your white shirt. Your peacock blue fountain pen has leaked through your pocket. Your head explodes with an obscenity, and your stomach is a spike of panic over the simmering nerves. You're an idiot, and everything's ruined. That's the exact color of Joshua's eyes when he looks at me. I wish I could say he's ugly. He should be a short, fat troll with a cleft palate and watery eyes, a limping hunchback, warts and zits, yellow cheese teeth and onion sweat. But he's not. He's pretty much the opposite. More proof there's no justice in this world. My inbox pings. I flick my eyes abruptly away from Joshua's non-ugliness and notice Elaine has sent through a request for budget forecasting figures. I open up last month's report for reference and begin. I doubt this month's outlook is going to be much of an improvement. The publishing industry is sliding further downhill. I've heard the word restructure echoing a few times around these halls, and I know where that leads. Every time I step out of the elevator and see Joshua, I ask myself why I don't get a new job. I've been fascinated by publishing houses since a pivotal field trip when I was 11. I was already a passionate devourer of books. My life revolved around the weekly trip to the town library. I'd borrow the maximum number of titles allowed, and I could identify individual librarians by the sound their shoes made as they moved up each aisle. Until that field trip, I was hell-bent on being a librarian myself. I'd even implemented a cataloging system for my own personal collection. I was such a little book nerd. Before our trip to the publishing house, I'd never thought much about how a book came to actually exist. It was a revelation. You could be paid to find authors, read books, and ultimately create them? Brand new covers and perfect pages with no dog ears or pencil annotations? My mind was blown. I loved new books. They were my favorite to borrow. I told my parents when I got home, I'm going to work at a publisher when I grow up. It's great that I'm fulfilling a childhood dream. But if I'm honest, at the moment, the main reason I don't get a new job is I can't let Joshua win this. As I work, all I can hear are his machine gun keystrokes and the faint whistle of air conditioning. He occasionally picks up his calculator and taps on it. I wouldn't mind betting Mr. Bexley has also directed Joshua to run the forecasting figures. Then the two co-CEOs can march into battle, armed with numbers that may not match. The ideal fuel for their bonfire of hatred. Excuse me, Joshua? He doesn't acknowledge me for a full minute. His keystrokes intensify. Beethoven on a piano has nothing on him right now. What is it, Lucinda? Not even my parents call me Lucinda. I clench my jaw, but then guiltily release the muscles. My dentist has begged me to make a conscious effort. Are you working on the forecasting figures for next quarter? He lifts both hands from his keyboard and stares at me. No. I let out half a lung full of air and turn back to my desk. I finished those 2 hours ago. He resumes typing. I look at my open spreadsheet and count to 10. We both work fast and have reputations for being finishers. You know, the type of worker who completes the nasty, too hard tasks everyone else avoids. I prefer to sit down with people and discuss things face to face. Joshua is strictly email. At the foot of his emails is always RGDSJ. Would it kill him to type regards Joshua? It's too many keystrokes, apparently. He probably knows offhand how many minutes a year he's saving BNG. We're evenly matched, but we are completely at odds. I try my hardest to look corporate, but everything I own is slightly wrong for B&G. I'm a gammon to the bone. My lipstick is too red, my hair too unruly. My shoes click too loudly on the tile floors. I can't seem to hand over my credit card to purchase a black suit. I never had to wear one at Gammon, and I'm stubbornly refusing to assimilate with the Bexleys. My wardrobe is knits and retro. A sort of cool librarian chic, I hope. It takes me 45 minutes to complete the task. I race the clock, even though numbers are not my forte, because I imagine it would have taken Joshua an hour. Even in my head, I compete with him. "Thanks, Lucy," I hear Elaine call faintly from behind her shiny office door when I send the document through. I recheck my inbox. Everything's up to date. I check the clock. 3:15 p.m. I check my lipstick in the reflection of the shiny wall tile near my computer monitor. I check Joshua, who is glowering at me with contempt. I stare back. Now we are playing the staring game. I should mention that the ultimate aim of all our games is to make the other smile or cry. It's something like that. I'll know when I win. I made a mistake when I first met Joshua. I smiled at him. My best sunny smile with all my teeth, my eyes sparkling with stupid optimism that the business merger wasn't the worst thing to ever happen to me. His eyes scanned me from the top of my head to the soles of my shoes. I'm only 5 feet tall, so it didn't take long. Then he looked away out the window. He did not smile back, and somehow I feel like he's been carrying my smile around in his breast pocket ever since. He's one up. After our initial poor start, it only took a few weeks for us to succumb to our mutual hostility. Like water dripping into a bathtub, eventually it began to overflow. I yawn behind my hand and look at Joshua's breast pocket, resting against his left pectoral. He wears an identical business shirt every day, in a different color. White, off-white stripe, cream, pale yellow, mustard, baby blue, robin's egg blue, dove gray, navy, and black. They are worn in their unchanging sequence. Incidentally, my favorite of his shirts is robin's egg blue, and my least favorite is mustard, which he is wearing now. All the shirts look fine on him. All colors suit him. If I wore mustard, I'd look like a cadaver. But there he sits, looking as golden-skinned and healthy as ever. "Mustard today," I observe aloud. Why do I poke the hornet's nest? Just can't wait for baby blue on Monday. The look he gives me is both smug and irritated. "You notice so much about me, Shortcake. But can I remind you that comments about appearance are against the B&G Human Resources policy?" The HR game. We haven't played this one in ages. Stop calling me Shortcake, or I'll report you to HR. We each keep a log on the other. I can only assume he does. He seems to remember all of my transgressions. Mine is a password-protected document hidden on my personal drive, and it journals all the shit that has ever gone down between Joshua Templeman and me. We have each complained to HR 4 times over this past year. He's received a verbal and written warning about the nickname he has for me. I've received 2 warnings. One for verbal abuse and for a juvenile prank that got out of hand. I'm not proud. He cannot seem to formulate a reply, and we resume staring at each other. I look forward to Joshua's shirts getting darker. It's navy today, which leads to black. Gorgeous payday black. My finances are something like this. I'm about to walk 25 minutes from B&G to pick up my car from Jerry, the mechanic, and melt my credit card to within 1 inch of its maximum limit. Payday comes tomorrow, and I will pay the credit card balance. My car will ooze more oily dark stuff all weekend, which I will notice by the time Joshua's shirts are the white of a unicorn's flank. I call Jerry, I return the car and subsist on a shoestring budget. The shirts get darker. I've got to do something about that car. Joshua is currently leaning on Mr. Bexley's doorframe. His body fills most of the doorway. I can see this because I'm spying via the reflection on the wall near my monitor. I hear a husky, soft laugh, nothing like Mr. Bexley's donkey bray. I rub my palms down my forearms to flatten the tiny hairs. I will not turn my head to try to see properly. He'll catch me. He always does. Then I'll get a frown. The clock is grinding slowly toward 5 p.m., and I can see thunderclouds through the dusty windows. Elaine left an hour ago. One of the perks of being co-CEO is working the hours of a school child and delegating everything to me. Mr. Bexley spends longer hours here because his chair is way too comfortable, and when the afternoon sun slants in, he tends to doze. I don't mean to sound like Joshua and I are running the top floor, but frankly, it feels like it sometimes. The finance and sales teams report directly to Joshua, and he filters the huge amounts of data into a bite-sized report that he spoon-feeds to a struggling, red-faced Mr. Bexley. I have the editorial, corporate, and marketing teams reporting to me, and each month I condense their monthly reports into one for Elaine, and I suppose I spoon-feed it to her, too. I spiral-bind it so she can read it when she's on the stepper. I use her favorite font. Every day here is a challenge, a privilege, a sacrifice, and a frustration. But when I think about every little step I've taken to be here in this place, starting from when I was 11 years old, I refocus. I remember. And I endure Joshua for a little longer. I bring homemade cakes to my meetings with the division heads, and they all adore me. I'm described as worth my weight in gold. Joshua brings bad news to his divisional meetings, and his weight is measured in other substances. Mr. Bexley stumps past my desk now, briefcase in hand. He must shop at Humpty Dumpty's big and small menswear. How else could he find such short, broad suits? He's balding, liver-spotted, and rich as sin. His grandfather started Bexley Books. He loves to remind Elaine that she was merely hired. He is an old degenerate, according to both Elaine and my own private observations. I make myself smile up at him. His first name is Richard. Fat little dick. Good night, Mr. Bexley.
Good night, Lucy.
He pauses by my desk to look down the front of my red silk blouse.
I hope Joshua passed on the copy of The Glass Darkly I picked up for you. The first of the first.
Fat little dick has a huge bookshelf filled with every B&G release. Each book is the first off the press, a tradition started by his grandfather. He loves to brag about them to visitors, but I once looked at the shelves, and the spines weren't even cracked.
You picked it up, eh?
Mr. Bexley orbits around to look at Joshua.
You didn't mention that, Dr. Josh.
Fat little dick probably calls him Dr. Josh because he's so clinical. I heard someone say when things got particularly bad at Bexley Books, Joshua masterminded the surgical removal of one-third of their workforce. I don't know how he sleeps at night.
As long as you get it, it doesn't matter.
Joshua replies smoothly, and his boss remembers that he is the boss.
Yes, yes.
He chuffs and looks down my top again.
Good work, you pair.
He gets into the elevator, and I look down at my shirt. All the buttons are done up. What could he even see? I glance up at the mirror tiles on the ceiling and can faintly see a tiny triangle of shadowed cleavage.
If you buttoned it any higher, we wouldn't see your face, Joshua says to his computer screen as he logs off.
Perhaps you could tell your boss to look at my face occasionally.
I also log off. He's probably trying to see your circuit board, or wondering what kind of fuel you run on.
I shrug on my coat. Just fueled by my hate for you. Josh's mouth twitches once, and I nearly had him there. I watch him roll down a neutral expression.
If it bothers you, you should speak to him. Stand up for yourself. So, painting your nails tonight, desperately alone? Lucky guess on his part? Yes. Masturbating and crying into your pillow tonight, Dr. Josh? He looks at the top button of my shirt. Yes, and don't call me that. I swallow down a bubble of laughter. We jostle each other in an unfriendly way as we get into the elevator. He hits B, but I hit G. Hitchhiking? Cars at the shop. I step into my ballet flats and tuck my heels into my back. Now I'm even shorter. In the dull polish of the elevator doors, I can see that I barely come halfway up his bicep. I look like a chihuahua next to a Great Dane. The elevator doors open to the building foyer. The world outside B&G is a blue haze, refrigerator cold, filled with rapists and murderers and lightly sprinkling rain. A sheet of newspaper blows past, right on cue. He holds the elevator door open with one enormous hand and leans out to look at the weather. Then he swings those dark blue eyes to mine, his brow beginning to crease. The familiar bubble forms in my head. I wish he was my friend. I burst it with a pin. I'll give you a ride, he forces out. Ugh, no way, I say over my shoulder, and run. Chapter 2. It's Cream Shirt Wednesday. Joshua is off on a late lunch. He's made a few more comments to me lately about things I like and do. They have been so accurate, I'm pretty sure he's been snooping through my stuff. Knowledge is power, and I don't have much. First, I conduct a forensic examination of my desk. Both Elaine and Mr. Bexley despise computerized calendars, and so we have to keep matching paper schedule books like we're Dickensian law clerks. In mine, there's only Elaine's appointments. I obsessively lock my computer, even if I go to the printer. My unlocked computer in the vicinity of Joshua? I may as well hand him the nuclear codes now. Back at Gammon Publishing, my desk was a fort made of books. I kept my pens in the gaps between their spines. When I was unpacking in the new office, I saw how sterile Joshua kept his desk and felt incredibly childish. I took my Word of the Day calendar and Smurf figurines home again. Before the merger, I had a best friend at work. Val Stone and I would sit on the worn-out leather couches in the break room and play our favorite game, systematically defacing photographs of beautiful people in magazines. I'd add a mustache onto Naomi Campbell. Val would then ink out a missing tooth. Soon it was an onslaught of scars and eye patches and bloodshot eyes and devil horns, until the picture was so ruined, we'd get bored and start another. Val was one of the staff who was cut, and she was furious I didn't give her some kind of warning. Not that I would have been allowed to, even if I had known. She didn't believe me. I turn slowly, and my reflection spins off 20 different surfaces. I see myself in every size, from music box to silver screen. My cherry red skirt flips out, and I pirouette once again, just for the hell of it, trying to shake away the sick, troubled feeling I get whenever I think of Val. Anyway, my audit confirms that my desk has a red, black, and blue pen, pink post-its, one tube of lipstick, a box of tissues for blotting my lipstick, and tears of frustration. My planner. Nothing else. I do a light, shuffling tap dance across the marble superhighway. I'm in Joshua country now. I sit in his chair and look at everything through his eyes. His chair is so high my toes don't touch the ground. I wiggle my butt a little deeper into the leather. It feels completely obscene. I keep one eye permanently swiveled toward the elevator and use the other to examine his desk for clues. His desk is the male version of mine. Blue post-its. He has a sharp pencil in with his three pens. Instead of lipstick, he has a tin of mints. I steal one and put it in the tiny, previously useless pocket of my shirt.
I imagine myself in the laxative section of the drugstore, trying to find a good match and have a good little snicker. I jiggle his desk drawer. Locked. So is his computer. Fort Knox. Well played, Templeman. I make a few unsuccessful guesses at his password. Maybe he doesn't hate me for Eva. There's no little framed photo of a partner or loved one on this desk. No grinning happy dog or tropical beach memento. I doubt he esteems anyone enough to frame their likeness. During one of Joshua's fervent little sales rants, fat little Dick boomed sarcastically,
"We've got to get you laid, Dr. Josh."
Joshua replied, "You're right, boss. I've seen what a bad drought can do to someone." He said it while looking at me. I know the date. I diarized it in my HR log. I get a little tingle in my nostrils. Joshua's cologne? The pheromone he leeches from his pores? Gross. I flip open his day planner and notice something. A light coat of pencil running down the columns of each day. Feeling incredibly James Bondish, I raise my phone and manage to take one single frame. I hear the cables in the elevator shaft and leap to my feet. I vault to the other side of his desk and manage to slam the planner shut before the doors spring open and he appears. His chair is still spinning gently out of the corner of my eye. Busted.
What are you doing?
My phone is now safely down the waistband of my underwear. Note to self. Disinfect phone. Nothing. There's a tremor in my voice, convicting me instantly. I was trying to see if it's going to rain this afternoon. I bumped your chair. Sorry. He advances like a floating Dracula. The menace is ruined by the sporting goods store bag loudly crinkling against his leg. A shoebox is in it, judging from the shape. Imagine the wretched sales assistant who had to help Joshua choose shoes.
I require shoes to ensure I can effectively run down the targets I am paid to assassinate in my spare time. I require the best value for my money. I am size 11.
He looks at his desk, his computer's innocuous login screen, his closed planner. I force my breath out in a controlled hiss. Joshua drops his bag on the floor. He steps so close his leather shoe touches the tip of my little patent heels. Now why don't you tell me what you were actually doing near my desk? We have never done the staring game this close. I'm a pipsqueak at exactly 5 feet tall. It's been my lifelong cross to bear. My lack of height is an agonizing topic of conversation. Joshua is at least 6'4". 5, 6, maybe more. A giant of a human. And he's built out of heavy materials. Gamely, I maintain eye contact. I can stand wherever I like in this office. Screw him. Like a threatened animal trying to look bigger, I put my hands on my hips. He's not ugly, as I've mentioned, but I always struggle to work out how to describe him. I remember eating my dinner on the couch a while back, and a soft news piece came on the TV. An old Superman comic book sold for a record price at auction. As the white-gloved hand turned the pages, the old-fashioned drawings of Clark Kent reminded me of Joshua. Like Clark Kent, Joshua's height and strength are all tucked away under clothes designed to conceal and help him blend into a crowd. Nobody at the Daily Planet knows anything about Clark. Underneath these button-up shirts, Joshua could be relatively featureless, or ripped like Superman. It's a mystery. He doesn't have the forehead curl or the nerdy black glasses, but he's got the strong masculine jawline and sulky pretty mouth. I've been thinking all this time his hair is black, but now that I'm closer, I can see it as dark brown. He doesn't comb it as neatly as Clark does. He's definitely got the ink blue eyes and the laser stare, and probably some of the other superpowers too. But Clark Kent is such a darling, all bumbling and soft. Joshua is hardly the mild-mannered reporter.
He's a sarcastic, cynical, bizarro Clark Kent, terrorizing everyone in the newsroom and pissing off poor little Lois Lane until she screams into her pillow at night. I don't like big guys. They're too much like horses. They could trample you if you got underfoot. He is auditing my appearance with the same narrowed eyes that I am. I wonder what the top of my head looks like. I'm sure he only fornicates with Amazons. Our stares clash, and maybe comparing them to an ink stain was a tad too harsh. Those eyes are wasted on him. To avoid dying, I reluctantly breathe in a steady lungful of cedar pine spice. He smells like a freshly sharpened pencil. A Christmas tree in a cold, dark room. Despite the tendons in my neck beginning to cramp, I don't permit myself to lower my eyes. I might look at his mouth then, and I get a good enough view of his mouth when he's tossing insults at me across the office. Why would I want to see it up close? I wouldn't. The elevator bings like the answer to all my prayers. Enter Andy the Courier. Andy looks like a movie extra who appears in the credits as Courier. Leathery, mid-40s, clad in fluorescent yellow. His sunglasses sit like a tiara on top of his head. Like most couriers, he enriches his workday by flirting with every female under the age of 60 he encounters. Lovely Luce! He booms it so loud I hear fat little Dick make a wet snort as he jolts awake in his office. Andy! I return, skittering backward. I could honestly hug him for interrupting what was feeling like a whole new kind of strange game. He has a small parcel in his hand, no bigger than a Rubik's Cube. It's got to be my 1984 baseball player Smurfette. Super rare, very minty. I've wanted her forever, and I've been stalking her journey via her tracking number. I know you want me to call from the foyer with your Smurfs, but no answer. My desk phone is diverted to my personal cell, which is currently located near my hip bone in the waistband of my underwear. So that's what the buzzing feeling was. Phew. I was thinking I needed my head checked. What does he mean, Smurfs? Joshua narrows his eyes like we're nuts. I'm sure you're busy, Andy. I'll let you get out of here. I grab at the parcel, but it's too late. It's her passion in life. She lives and breathes Smurfs. Those little blue people, yay big? They wear white hats? Andy holds two of his fingers an inch apart. I know what Smurfs are. Joshua is irritated. I don't live or breathe them. My voice betrays the lie. Joshua's sudden cough sounds suspiciously like a laugh. Smurfs, huh? So that's what those little boxes are. I thought maybe you were buying your tiny clothes online. Do you think it's appropriate to get personal items delivered to your workplace, Lucinda? She's got a whole cabinet of them. She's got a... what is it? Luce? Thomas Edison Smurf? He's a rare one, Josh. Her parents gave it to her for high school graduation. Andy blithely continues humiliating me. Quiet now, Andy. How are you? How's your day going? I sign for the package on his handheld device with a sweaty hand. Him and his big mouth. Your parents bought you a Smurf for graduation? Joshua lounges in his chair and watches me with cynical interest. I hope my body didn't warm the leather. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure you got a car or something. I'm mortified. I'm fine, sweetheart, Andy tells me, taking the little gizmo back from me and hitting several buttons and putting it in his pocket. Now that the business component of our interaction is completed, he pulls his mouth into a beguiling grin. All the better for seeing you. I tell you, Josh, my friend, if I sat opposite this gorgeous little creature, I wouldn't get any work done. Andy hooks his thumbs into his pockets and smiles at me. I don't want to hurt his feelings, so I roll my eyes good-humoredly. It's a struggle, Joshua says sarcastically. Be glad you get to leave. He must have a heart of stone. He sure does. If I can knock him out and get him into a crate, can you have him delivered somewhere remote? I lean on my desk and look at my tiny parcel. International shipping rates have increased, Andy warns. Joshua shakes his head, bored with the conversation, and begins to log on.
I've got some savings. I think Joshua would love an adventure vacation in Zimbabwe.
You've got an evil streak, haven't you?
Andy's pocket makes a beep, and he begins to rummage and walk to the elevator.
Well, lovely Luce, it's been a pleasure as always. I will see you soon, no doubt after your next online auction.
Bye. When he disappears into the elevator, I turn back to my desk, my face automatically faded to neutral.
Absolutely pathetic.
I make a Jeopardy buzzer sound. Who is Joshua Templeman?
Lucinda, flirting with couriers.
Pathetic. Joshua is hammering away on his keyboard. He certainly is an impressive touch typist. I stroll past his desk and am gratified by his frustrated backspacing. I'm nice to him.
You? Nice?
I'm surprised by how hurt I feel. I'm lovely. Ask anyone.
Okay. Josh, is she lovely?
He asks himself aloud.
Let me think.
He picks up his tin of mints, opens the lid, checks them, closes it, and looks at me. I open my mouth and lift my tongue like a mental patient at the medication window.
She's got a few lovely things about her, I suppose.
I raise a finger and enunciate the words crisply. Human resources. He sits up straighter, but the corner of his mouth moves. I wish I could use my thumbs to pull his mouth into a huge, deranged grin. As the police drag me out in handcuffs, I'll be screeching, "Smile, goddamn you!" We need to get even, because it's not fair. He's gotten one of my smiles and seen me smile at countless other people. I have never seen him smile, nor have I seen his face look anything but blank, bored, surly, suspicious, watchful, resentful. Occasionally he has another look on his face after we've been arguing. His serial killer expression. I walk down the center line of the tile again and feel his head swivel. Not that I care what you think, but I'm well-liked here. Everyone's excited about my book club, which you've made pretty clear you think is lame, but it will be team-building and pretty relevant, given where we work.
You're a captain of industry.
I take the library donations out. I plan the Christmas party. I let the interns follow me around. I'm ticking them off on my fingers.
You're not doing much to convince me you don't care what I think.
He leans back farther into his chair, long fingers laced together loosely on his generic flat abdomen. The button near his thumb is half loose. Whatever my face does, it makes him glance down and rebutton it. I don't care what you think, but I want normal people to like me.
You're chronically addicted to making people adore you.
The way he says it makes me feel a little sick. Well, excuse me for doing my best to maintain a good reputation, for trying to be positive. You're addicted to making people hate you, so what a pair we are. I sit down and tap my computer mouse about 10 times as hard as I can. His words sting. Joshua is like a mirror that shows me the bad parts of myself. It's school all over again. Tiny, runt-of-the-litter Lucy, using her pathetic cuteness to avoid being destroyed by the big kids. I've always been the pet, the lucky charm, the one being pushed on the swings or pulled in a wagon, carried and coddled, and perhaps I am a little pathetic.
You should try not giving a shit sometime. I tell you, it's liberating.
His mouth tightens, and a strange shadow clouds his expression. One blink, and it's gone. I didn't ask for your advice, Joshua. I get so mad at myself, letting you drag me down to your level all the time.
And what level are you imagining me dragging you down to?
His voice is a little velvety, and he bites his lip.
Horizontal?
Mentally, I hit enter in my HR log and begin a new line. You're disgusting. Go to hell. I think I'll go treat myself to a basement scream.
There you go. You've got no problem telling me to go to hell. It's a good start. It kind of suits you. Now, try it with other people. You don't even realize how much people walk all over you. How do you expect to be taken seriously?
Quit giving the same people deadline extensions month after month.
I don't know what you mean.
Julie?
It's not every month. I hate him because he's right.
It's every single month, and you have to bust your ass working late to meet your own deadline.
Do you see me doing that?
No. Those assholes downstairs give it to me on time.
I dredge up a phrase from the assertiveness self-help book I keep on my nightstand. I don't want to continue this conversation.
I'm giving you some good advice here. You should take it.
Stop picking up Elaine's dry cleaning. It's not your job.
I am now ending this conversation.
I stand up. Maybe I'll go and play in the afternoon traffic to let off steam.
And the courier. Just leave him alone. The sad old guy thinks you're flirting with him.
That's what people say about you. The unfortunate retort falls out of my mouth. I try to rewind time. It doesn't work.
Is that what you think you and I do? Flirt?
He reclines back in his chair in a way I can never manage to do. The back of my chair doesn't budge when I try to recline. I only succeed in rolling backward and bumping into the wall.
Shortcake, if we were flirting, you'd know about it.
Our eyes catch, and I feel a weird drop inside. This conversation is running off the rails.
Because I'd be traumatized?
Because you'd be thinking about it later on, lying in bed.
Been imagining my bed, have you?
I managed to reply.
He blinks, a new rare expression spreading across his face.
I want to slap it off. It looks like he knows something I don't. It's smug and male, and I hate it.
I bet it's a very small bed.
I'm nearly breathing fire. I went around his desk, kick his feet wider, and stand between his spread legs. I'd put one knee on the little triangle of chair right below his groin, climb up a little, and make him grunt with pain. I'd pull his tie loose and unbutton the neck of his shirt. I'd put my hands around his big tan throat and squeeze his hot skin underneath my fingertips, his body struggling against me, cedar and pine spicing the air between us, burning my nostrils like smoke.
What are you imagining? Your expression is filthy.
Strangling you. Bare hands. I can barely get the words out. I'm huskier than a phone sex operator after a double shift.
So that's your kink.
His eyes are going dark. Only where you're concerned. Both his eyebrows ratchet up. And he opens his mouth as his eyes go completely black. But he does not seem to be able to say a word. It is wonderful. It's a baby blue shirt day when I remember the photo I took of his planner. After I read the Publishing Quarterly Outlook report and make an executive summary for Elaine, I transfer the photo from my phone to my work computer. Then I glance around like a criminal. Joshua has been in Fat Little Dick's office all morning, and weirdly, the morning has dragged. It's so quiet in here without someone to hate. I hit print, lock my computer, and clatter down the hall. I photocopy it twice, making the resolution darker and darker until the pencil marks are better visible. Needless to say, I shred all unneeded evidence. I wish I could double shred it. Joshua's been locking away his planner now. I lean against the wall and tilt the page to the light. The photograph captures a Monday and Tuesday a couple of weeks back. I can see Mr. Bexley's appointments easily. But next to the Monday is a letter. D. The Tuesday is an S. There is a tally of tiny lines adding up to 8. Dots next to times near lunchtime, a line of 4 X's and 6 little slash marks. I puzzle covertly over this all afternoon. I'm tempted to go to security and ask Scott for the security tapes for this time period, but Elaine might find out. It'd definitely be a waste of company resources, too, over and above my illicit photocopying and general slacking. The answer doesn't come for some time. It's late afternoon, and Joshua is back in his regular seat across from me. His blue shirt glows like an iceberg. When I finally work out how to decode the pencil marks, I slap my forehead. I can't believe I've been so slow. Thanks. I've been dying to do that all afternoon, Joshua says without taking his eyes from his monitor. He doesn't know I've seen his planner and the pencil codes. I'll simply notice when he uses the pencil and work out the correlation. Let the spying game begin. Chapter 3. I don't get quick results with the spying game, and by the time Joshua is dressed in dove gray, I'm at my wit's end. He has sensed my heightened interest in his activities and has become even more furtive and suspicious. I'll have to coax him out. I'm never going to see the pencil in motion if all he does is half frown at his computer. I start a game I call "You're Just So..." It goes like this. "You're just so..." Never mind. I sigh. He takes the bait. Handsome. Intelligent. No, wait. Superior to everyone? You're coming to your senses, Lucinda. Joshua locks his computer and opens his planner, one hand hovering over the cup with the pens and pencils. I hold my breath. He frowns and slaps the planner shut. The gray shirt should make him look like a cyborg, but he ends up looking handsome and intelligent. He is the worst. "You're just so... predictable." Somehow I know this will cut him deep. His eyes become slits of hatred. "Oh, am I? How so?" "You're just so" basically gives both players free rein to tell the opponent how much they hate each other. Shirts, moods, patterns. People like you can't succeed. If you ever acted out of character and surprised me, I'd die of shock. Am I to take this as a personal challenge? He looks at his desk, apparently deep in thought. I'd like to see you attempt it. You're just so inflexible.
And you're just so flexible?
Very. I fell right into that one. And it's true. I could get my foot up to my face right now. I recover by raising an eyebrow and looking up at the ceiling with a smirk. By the time I lock eyes with him again, my mouth is a neutral little rosebud, mirrored off 100 glittering surfaces. He drops his eyes slowly down to the floor, and I cross my ankles, belatedly remembering I kicked off my shoes earlier. It's hard to be a good nemesis when your bright red toenails are showing. If I did something out of character, you'd die of shock. I can see my face mirrored on the paneling near his shoulder. I look like a black-eyed, wild-maned version of myself. My dark hair falls around my shoulders in jagged flames. Might be worth my while, then. Monday to Friday, he turns me into a scary-looking woman. I look like a gypsy fortune teller screaming about your imminent death. A crazed lunatic in an asylum, seconds from clawing her own eyes out. Well, well, Lucinda Hutton. One flexible little gal. He is reclining in his chair again. Both feet are flat on the floor, and they point at me like revolvers in a Wild West shootout. HR, I clip at him. I'm losing this game, and he knows it. Calling HR is virtually like tapping out. He picks up the pencil and presses the sharpened tip against the pad of his thumb. If a human could grin without moving their face, he just did it. I meant, you're just so flexible in your approach to things. It must have been your wholesome upbringing, Shortcake. What do your parents do again? Could you remind me?
You know exactly what they do. I'm too busy for this nonsense. I grab a stack of old post-its and begin to sort them. They farm. He looks at the ceiling, pretending to be racking his brains. They farm. He leaves it dangling in the air for an eternity. It's agony. I try not to fill the silence, but the word that amuses him so much comes out of my mouth like a curse. Strawberries. Hence the nickname, Strawberry Shortcake. I indulge myself in molar grinding. My dentist will never know.
Sky Diamond Strawberries. Cute. Look, I've got the blog bookmarked.
He does two double clicks with his mouse and swivels his computer screen to face me. I cringe so hard I sprain something internally. How did he find this? My mom's probably calling out to my dad right now. Nigel, honey, the blog's had a hit. The Sky Diamond Daily. Yes, you heard right. Daily. I haven't checked it in a while because I can't keep up. Mom was a journalist with the local newspaper when she met Dad, but she quit to have me, and then they opened the farm. When you know her backstory, the daily entries make a sad kind of sense. I squint at Joshua's screen. Today's feature story is about irrigation. Our farm supplies three local farmers' markets, as well as a grocery chain. There's a field for tourists to pick their own, and Mom sells jars of preserves. In hot weather, she makes homemade ice cream. Sky Diamond was certified organic 2 years ago, which was a pretty big deal for them. Business ebbs and flows, dependent on the weather. When I go home, I still have to take my turn at the front gate, explaining to visitors the flavor differences between Irleglow and Diamante strawberries, Camino Reals and Everbearers. They all sound like the names of cool old cars. Not many people look at my name badge and make the connection with the farm's name. The Beatles fans who do are deeply, smugly pleased with themselves. I bet you can guess what I eat when I'm homesick. No. You didn't. How did you... And you know, there's the nicest family picture somewhere... Here. He clicks again, barely needing to glance at the screen. His eyes light with evil amusement as he watches me. How nice. It's your parents, right? Who's this adorable little girl with black hair? Is it your little cousin? No. It's a pretty old picture. He makes the picture fill his entire screen. I'm turning redder than a flippin' strawberry. It's me, of course. It's a photo I don't think I've ever seen. The blurred tree line in the background orients me instantly. I turned 8 when my parents put those new rows into the west quarter block. Business was picking up then, which accounts for the pride in my parents' smiles. I'm not ashamed of my parents, but it never ceases to amuse those who were raised in the city. Most white-collared jackasses like Joshua find it so quaint and cute. They imagine my family as simple folk, hillbillies on the side of a hill covered in rambling vines. For people like Joshua, strawberries come from the store prepackaged in plastic boxes. In this picture, I'm sprawled at my parents' feet like a foal. I'm wearing stained, dirty short overalls, and my crinkly dark hair is a scribble. I have my patchwork library satchel looped around my body, no doubt crammed with the Babysitter's Club and old-fashioned horse stories. One of my hands is in a plant, the other filled with berries. I'm flushed from sun and possibly a vitamin C overdose. Maybe it's why I'm so small. It stunted my growth. You know, she looks a lot like you. Maybe I should send the link in an all-staff email to B&G, asking them who they think this wild little girl could be. He is visibly trembling with the need to laugh. I will kill you. I do look completely wild in this photo. My eyes are lighter than the sky as I squint against the sun and do my best big smile. The same smile I've been doing all my life. I begin to feel a pressure in my throat, a burning in my sinuses. I stare at my parents. They're both so young. My dad's back is straight in this photo, but each time I go home, he's a little more stooped over. I flick my eyes to Joshua, and he doesn't look like he wants to laugh anymore. My eyes prick with tears before I stop to think of where I am and whom I'm sitting